So we come to the last part. It's part six of the Gospel. It's the Passion narrative. It was 2 days before the Passover. Now the Passover we know from John's Gospel that year was on the Sabbath. So we're talking about Thursday. And the Sabbath, the Passover, as still with us, is the first full moon after the spring equinox. So it's 2 days before the Passover and the Festival of Unleavened Bread. These were two quite distinct feasts in ancient Israel. The Passover is, of course, a pastoral feast. The Unleavened Bread is an agricultural feast. But they're at the same time. So they kind of come in together. And the day of the Passover at the time of Jesus was the first day of the week-long celebrations of the unleavened bread. So the chief priests and the scribes were looking for a way to arrest Jesus by stealth. They've been looking for this for a while, but now it involves the chief priests as well, and it's to do with the emptying of the temple. They were determined to kill him. And they said, we mustn't do it during the festival, or there may be a riot among the people. Why was it Bethany in the house of Simon the leper? As he sat at the table, a woman came in with an alabaster jar of very costly aromatic oil. The Greek is myrrh, from the spikenard plant. And she broke open the jar and poured the ointment on his head. The Gospels have got different ways of looking at this, but this is Mark. Anointing on the head was used for hospitality, consecration. Some were there who said to one another in anger, they're not named, why was the ointment wasted in this way? This ointment could have been sold for more than 300 denarii, that's a year's wages, and the money could have been given to the poor. And they scolded her. But Jesus said, let her alone. Why do you trouble her? She has performed a good service for me. You always have the poor with you. You can show kindness to them whenever you wish. But you'll not always have me. There's got to be a link back to the fasting and the bridegroom. Once again, they're right. The money could have been given to the poor. That's a level of importance, of course. But there's something more basic. The bridegroom is with them, and she's done this act of love. She's done what she could, says Jesus. She's anointed my body beforehand for its burial. Truly, I tell you, whenever the good news is proclaimed in the whole world, what she has done will be told in remembrance of her. A little bit strange in a way, because we don't know who it is from Mark. She's not named. The other Gospels will fill that gap in, and we're just doing with Mark. So a woman out of love has brought a very expensive, extraordinarily expensive jar of myrrh and anointed him and for burial, metaphorically. Judas Iscariot, who was one of the 12, went to the chief priests in order to hand Jesus over to them. When they heard it, they were greatly pleased and promised to give him money. So he began to look for an opportunity to betray Jesus. We're given so little information, one has to speculate. And since Jesus chose Judas, Judas must have had quite strong leadership qualities. But it seems that his idea of the Messiah is still unconverted. So I assume, but it is an assumption, that what Judas wants to do is bring about a confrontation between Jesus and the religious leaders, a confrontation which he's quite convinced Jesus, the Messiah, will win. When Jesus doesn't win, Judas doesn't know what to do. His failure was to really understand the kind of Messiah that Jesus is. On the first day of unleavened bread, the day the Passover lamb is sacrificed, his disciples say to him, "Where do you want to go to make the preparations for you to eat the Passover?" Just pause. In fact, this is not a Passover meal. But it's happening the night before the Passover meal, so it obviously has all that surrounding implications and sense and so on. John makes it clear that the meal was actually the day before. But it's given Passover significance not only by the disciples, by Jesus himself. Because at this meal, as you know, there's no Passover lamb and there's nothing mentioned about the questions that are asked and these special herbs that are used at the meal. This is a meal among very intimate friends. In fact, it ends up being Jesus' last meal. But he sends the disciples in to prepare the Passover. So he sent two of his disciples saying to them, "Go into the city, and a man carrying a jar of water will meet you. Follow him. And wherever he enters, say to the owner of the house, 'The teacher asks,'" so he must be already known to this man from a previous visit, "'Say to the owner, the teacher asks, where is my guest room where I may eat the Passover with my disciples? He will show you a large room upstairs, furnished and ready. Make preparations for us there.' So the disciples set out, went to the city, and found everything as Jesus had taught them. And they prepared the Passover meal." When it was evening, Jesus comes with the 12. So we're on Thursday evening. "And when they'd taken their places and were eating, Jesus said, 'Truly I tell you, one of you will betray me. One who is eating with me.'" An allusion to Psalm 41, where the psalmist says, "I could have lived with this if an enemy had done it. But someone who ate with me, someone who shared table with me, someone who was friendly with me." And that's an image here. "They began to be distressed, and they say to him one after another, 'Surely not I.' And Jesus said to them, 'It's one of the 12. Implication being, and the word disciples has already been used, there are more than the 12 there, but this is one of the 12. "One who is dipping bread into the bowl with me. For the Son of Man goes as it is written of him. But woe to that one by whom the Son of Man is betrayed." it would have been better for that one not to have been born. Very poignant statement. Don't think in terms of hell or anything, for heaven's sake. But whatever's happening here is disastrous for the person betraying him. While they were eating, taking a loaf of bread and blessing, Jesus broke it, gave it to them, and said, "Take, this is my body." It sounds simple, but it's not. Soma in Greek, that's the Greek there. Soma, my body. Problem is, there's no word for body in Aramaic or Hebrew. This is a very practical, and body is a construct that we make. The Greeks made it. And they also sometimes contrasted it with the soul. So we've got a body and a soul. Well, that's not Aramaic thinking. That's not part of the culture. I think, and the New Testament is a difficult period because the word Paul sometimes uses soma. John uses the word flesh. Now, that is a Hebrew word. Flesh meaning the vulnerable, the flesh, which you can see. So I suggest to you the best translation for soma in the New Testament is person. This is me. This is myself. Without all the tricky implications of psychology and body and soul and all the different ideas among the Greeks about that. So he's giving himself to them when he gives them this bread. There's nothing new there. Taking a cup and giving thanks, and I've put the Greek there, eucharisteo, Eucharist, that's a Greek word from there, where the word comes from. Giving thanks is Eucharisting. He gave it to them, the cup. All of them drank from it. And he said to them, "This is my blood." So it's the blood of the grape. This is my blood. The blood of the covenant. The new covenant. Which is poured out. And here we have this same word again. We talked about yesterday. Poured out for many. Poured out for the multitude. Poured out for, in fact, anyone who wants it. Truly I tell you, I'll never again drink of the fruit of the vine until that day when I drink it new in the kingdom of God. It's going to be his last meal with them before his death. There are echoes here of his statement when James and John came to him in Mark's account and said, "We want to be on your left and on your right in your kingdom." He said, "Well, can you drink the cup that I have to drink, drink it to the dregs, life, what it's going. Can you continue loving even if it brings pain and suffering?" And they said yes. And now bear with me, I'm going to give you a philosophical 5 minutes. If it doesn't help, let it go over your head. We have experiences. We experience things with our senses. See, touch, smell, taste, hear. And our senses only get to the surface of things. What's palpable and seeable and measurable. And that's what our senses are for. You all know that. They only touch the surface of things. But thank God we've got another thing called the intelligence. From Latin, intus legere, to read within. So right from our early childhood, I don't know when it starts, to some kids it seems to start in a few months, but anyhow, very quickly, we all started to say, what is it? Why? We asked questions because our mind, our intelligence wanted to penetrate. It looks like this, but what is it? Now, our purpose of that intelligence is to get to the underlying reality, not just what you can see and taste and touch and hear and smell, but what is it that I'm experiencing? Well, the Latin for that is substantia, the substance. Look at the word. You can stance is standing, sub is under. So the substance of reality is what we understand. It's exactly the same word. Understanding is reaching to the substance, not just the appearance. Now, substance can be two things that can be easily misunderstood. Today, the word substance generally means the matter. What is the substance? What is it? Meaning, what's its matter? It's not a philosophical usage of the word. It's about, well, it's wood, we might say, or it's glass, or it's some kind of... what's that stuff they make everything out of these days?
Plastic,
that's the word, exactly. It's plastic. But that's not what the word means in the philosophical tradition that's come right through. The philosophical question is, substance means, in the metaphysical sense, the underlying reality, substance, that which is, which it is, however it might appear. In St. Thomas Aquinas and in the Council of Trent and in our catechisms still, we grew up with the word transubstantiation. It's actually a perfect word for what we're talking about. The problem is it needs unpacking because we don't tend to think of substance in a metaphysical sense. Transubstantiation means the substance is different, it's changed. The underlying reality is no longer the same. Something's happened so that the underlying reality is different. In other words, we attain truth. That's what we're looking for when we say, what is it? We want the truth. We are right in our judgment as to what something is. Thomas Aquinas, I think, gives the most simple and direct translation. Adequatio rei et intellectus, when there's an equality between the thing and the understanding. That's what truth is, that you've got it right. You haven't misunderstood it, you haven't got caught away. No, your mind, your intellectus, is in accordance with the way things really are. Well, that's what truth is. Now, our understanding, your understanding and mine, isn't just chiseled because of philosophy of some kind or science or physics, mathematics. There's much more to us than that. Our understanding of reality is enlightened, not just by, it is enlightened by scientific discovery, but it's also enlightened by faith, by love. We learn a lot more in love than we could out of a physics book, by that process of what we open ourselves to beyond logic and beyond physics. Augustine says it absolutely beautifully. He says, don't seek to understand so that you may believe. No doubt he was surrounded by people who can't believe the Christian message till they understand it. And because they can't understand it, they either stay there frozen or they reject it because it can't be understood within the categories of their thinking. Well, that's kind of pathetic, really. Look at all the arts, music, dancing, painting. Oh, God, you go on forever. All that stuff tells you much more than the physics can tell you. So he says, look, don't seek to understand that you may believe. Believe so that you may understand. What a sensible statement. So when we come to the Jesus is giving them some bread. Of course it's bread. Physically and chemically it's still bread. The senses, that's what's called the species. The senses, it smells like bread, tastes like bread, whatever. It's chemically and physically bread and it always will be bread. Just as what we use at the altar doesn't change its substance in that physical sense, the matter. It's not a physical or chemical change. It's a metaphysical change. It's a change at the level of being, of reality, unmeasurable by the senses. We know in faith, and it is knowledge, but it's knowledge that's born out of love. We know in faith that Jesus is offering himself to assuage our deepest hunger and our deepest thirst. So when Jesus says at the Last Supper, take it, eat it, of course it's bread, physically, chemically. But no, no, he's giving it a new meaning. He's saying when you eat this bread, or let us use our words, this consecrated bread, when you eat this, I'm giving myself to you to nourish you at a far deeper level than your digestive system might require. Let's go somewhere else if you want a meal. But if you want to have your real hunger assuaged, take and eat this bread. And the wine, similarly. The wine is his life poured out for us on the cross, which we're going to come to and look at tomorrow morning. So pardon me, let's go back to the text. This is me. Jesus promises when you and I take, and we're meant to take it. I grew up, you probably did too, and we used to let someone put it on our tongue, which is what you do when people are dying and can't use their hands. But Jesus said, take it, well, take it. I can remember when this first came out after the Second Vatican Council, that we were allowed to take it. This is kind of, well, only I'll say it as it was. My mother was in a nursing home, and I was saying Mass for all these people who were what people are in a nursing home. So I explained what was, you know, it's important I explain it. So I explained what the Eucharist was happening. And I have to tell you, it was an overwhelming experience for me because all these doddering, struggling, hungry, old, sick people were coming up with great excitement to let Jesus place himself in their hands. Take it, he said. And they took it. And then they received, having taken it. Now there's been a bit of a problem in the church since. We've had a couple of popes, not our present one, who reckoned it was better to receive on the tongue, and then we have people in the Vatican high up in the trying to insist that one of them even said, Sara, he runs their liturgical business, that taking the host on the hand was the beginning of the disrespect for the Eucharist and people leaving Mass. And the poor Pope must be weeping, but he doesn't want to sack everybody, so he's got to do something. But come back to this. Take and eat, he said. Take it, eat it. I place myself in your hands. I entrust myself to you to take and to eat. Well, when they'd sung the hymn, they went out to the Mount of Olives. And Jesus said to them, "You'll all become deserters, for it's written, 'I'll strike the shepherd and the sheep will be scattered.'" And then he says something really lovely. "After I'm raised up by my Father, by God, I'll go before you to Galilee. You'll find me there. I'll be there. I'll still be with you. Different, of course, but really with you. So, almost, when you abandon me, please don't think I'm abandoning you." Peter said to him, "Even though all become deserters, I will not." Beautiful statement coming out of intense love. Of course he's not going to betray Jesus. He knows it. He doesn't know himself well enough yet. But he knows he's passionately concerned for him. He can't even think of the possibility of deserting Jesus. So he says it. And Jesus says to him, to Peter, "Truly I tell you, this day, this very night, before the cock crows twice," and that's not in the other Gospels, but it is in Mark, Peter's Gospel. How we're being told, anyway I can understand it, is that when Peter will do it, comes to deny Jesus, deny knowing him, even the first cock crow didn't warn him enough. It was only on the second one that he... So we can be pretty slow. So God will be patient with us. So when the cock crows twice, you'd think once would be enough, but no. When it does twice, you'll deny me three times. You'll persistently deny me. Peter says vehemently, "Even though I must die with you, I'll never deny you." And all of them said the same. They went to a place called Gethsemane, which means oil press, at the bottom of the Mount of Olives. Of course, you'd expect an oil press. So they went to this place, and he said to the disciples, "Sit here while I pray." He took with him Peter and James and John. And he began to be distressed and agitated. Hebrews talks about it, crying aloud and in silent tears. The Greek word here for distressed and agitated is really radical. It's like a breakdown, really, an emotional breakdown. And he says to them, "I'm deeply grieved." I will reflect with you in a moment what that might have been, and I can only give my best thoughts on it, and you'll have your own. "I'm deeply grieved even to death. Stay here. Keep awake." He needed them to keep awake. He needed them. Going a little further, he threw himself on the ground and prayed that if it were possible, the hour might pass from him. He said, "Abba, for you, everything's possible. Remove this cup from me." And then he comes to this profound prayer, "Yet, not what I want, but what you want." That has to be read so carefully. He wants to do his Father's will. That's always what he wants. We mustn't jump to conclusions as to what the Father's will is, so let's delay with it a bit more. He came and found them sleeping, and he said to Peter, "Simon, are you asleep? Couldn't you keep awake 1 hour? So let me reflect with you on this, and you have to do your own reflection, of course. Abba, for you all things are possible, remove this cup from me. Is Jesus afraid of crucifixion? Surely, who wouldn't be? It's a dreadful, the most dreadful way of killing the Romans invented. So it's awful and dreadful, so that would be a level, but there's something far deeper going on here. Is he broken? I think this is likely, because his mission has failed. He was sent by God, he knew it. He was sent to love, to reach out to people, to change the system, to sow in this world a seed of forgiveness and love and brotherly and sisterly care and all of community, all of that. That's what he came to do. But look around. The disciples aren't ready. So who is? Well, you might say his mother is. She's not on the scene here. And no doubt she is. But and there'd be individuals around who were. But on the whole, Jesus could be forgiven for thinking his mission had failed. Romans are still there. The Sicarii are still determined to violently overthrow the Roman thing and they'll end up destroying the city. And then the Pharisees are the same and the Sadducees are the same and the scribes are the same and the high priests are the same. What's different? Jesus wants more time to do his Father's will. And that's what it comes to. I don't want to die. It makes no sense to me, says Jesus. He might also be thinking, why not? Should I not have entered the temple so angrily? Was that a mistake? Is that what the problem is? Should I have been gentler with the Pharisees and not so abrupt? I mean, he's got all this going on in his human psyche. But it comes to the point, we've all got to come to this. Whatever happens, he's going to do his Father's will. What's his Father's will? Well, you may have grown up. I did. But as I told you earlier, I had a scattered brain, so it didn't do me a lot of harm. I didn't take much notice of it, I think. That God planned the crucifixion of Jesus to save the world. So this is all part of the unfolding of this eternal plan. Just live with that for a minute. No more than a minute, please. So God organises a murder to save the world. Pretty impressive, isn't it? Barmy. Whoever thought that theology up? Well, I could explain it, but I'm not here to do that now. What about this? What about if he knew his Father's will? Namely, Jesus. Whatever happens to you, and Jesus doesn't know what's going to happen. The high priest could well be converted. Wouldn't that be beautiful? Pilate may have had the courage to wash his hands and mean it and say, take him, this is stupid, there's nothing to do with me, and not gone along with the charade. The crowd may have been up in arms against the leaders who were trying to tell him to get Jesus crucified and release Barabbas. Any of that's possible. But Jesus can see the vultures circling. They've been out to get him for a long time. Now it's closing in. So he comes to the point, I know what I'll do, Father. I don't want to die, you know that. And I can't make any sense of it, you know that. But I'll continue to do your will. I'll continue to embrace lepers. Even though they said I shouldn't. I'll continue to heal on the Sabbath. I'll continue to reach people in the synagogue and restore them to health. Even though they get out there determined to destroy him when it happens. I'll continue to speak the truth in love. And I'll continue to give you and myself to people in love, come what may. I think that's what that. keep awake, he says. Keep praying, this is to the disciples, that you may not come into the time of trial. The spirit indeed is willing, but the flesh is weak. And again he went away and prayed, saying the same words. And once more he came and found them sleeping. Their eyes were very heavy and they didn't know what to say to him. He came a third time. Now, third time means he's coming back all the time. Coming back for comfort, for friendship, for support. He's not getting any, but he'd like it. He said to them, "Are you still sleeping and taking your rest? Enough. The hour has come. The Son of Man is betrayed into the hands of sinners. Get up. Let us go. My betrayer is at hand." While he was still speaking, Judas, one of the 12, arrives, and with him there was a crowd with swords and clubs from the chief priests and scribes and elders. They're from the Jewish age. There's no Roman soldiers there. When John tells the story, he's got a cohort of Roman soldiers there. So he's dramatizing it all differently for different reasons. But here we have Mark's simple account of what happened. Now the betrayer had given them a sign saying, "The one I will kiss is the man. Arrest him, lead him away under guard." So coming, he goes up to Jesus and says, "Rabbi, teacher, master," and kisses him. Then they laid hands on Jesus and arrested him. One of those who stood near drew his sword and struck the slave of the high priest, cutting off his ear. As the Gospels develop, that's the way folk stories grow, it ends up being his right ear, and then in the next Gospel his name is Malchus, like it's adding more and more to the story to make the point. So Jesus said to them, "Have you come out with swords and clubs to arrest me as though I were a bandit? Day after day I was with you in the temple teaching, and you didn't arrest me. But let the scriptures be fulfilled." All of them deserted him and fled. Luke, by the way, because he loves this, has Jesus heal the ear. Mark doesn't mention that. We're looking at Mark. A certain young man was following Jesus, wearing nothing but a linen cloth. They caught hold of him, and he left the linen cloth in their hands and ran off naked. What a strange little thing. You only find that in Mark's Gospel. Is he symbolic of a martyr, leaving behind the burial cloth, sharing in Jesus' death and the resurrection? Could be, because the same imagery of linen cloth comes back when the women go to the tomb. Maybe that's what Mark is saying. Or is this a dramatic contrast of unfaithful disciples and Jesus? Jesus didn't run away from being arrested, stripped, crucified, but this one, representing the followers of Jesus, runs away. I don't know. They took Jesus to the high priest, that's Caiaphas, and all the chief priests, the elders and the scribes are assembled. So this is on the Thursday night late or the Friday morning. It can't be the day of Passover because they couldn't have had a meeting and they all that they did going to see Pilate, that's all impossible. It's what happened because it was the day before the Passover. Passover started at sundown on the Friday night. Peter had followed Jesus at a distance, right into the courtyard of the high priest, and he was sitting with the guards, warming himself at the fire. Now the chief priests and the whole council were looking for testimony against Jesus to put him to death, but they couldn't find any. Many gave false testimony against Jesus, and their testimony didn't agree. Some stood up and gave false testimony against him, saying, "We heard him say, 'I'll destroy the temple made by human hands, and in 3 days I'll build another, not made with hands.'" But even on this point, their testimony didn't agree. Then the high priest stood up before them and asked Jesus, "Have you no answer? What is it that they testify against you?" But Jesus was silent. He had already advised in Mark and here the apostles and those to be silent when they're taken before the Sanhedrin, and that here he is silent himself. Again, the high priest asked him, "Are you the Messiah, the Son of the Blessed One?" And that doesn't add anything on. The Messiah is the King and therefore the Son of God. So it's another way of saying what the Messiah was in his view. Jesus said, "I am." It's quite confusing. All the Gospels, he gives a different answer. But here in Mark's Gospel, for the first time, Jesus does claim to be the Messiah. By now, he has shown, revealed what the Messiah is. The words he speaks are "ego eimi," used in that walking on the lake, the Greek words for Yahweh. So this is the presence of God here. "You will see the Son of Man seated at the right hand of the power and coming with the clouds of heaven." Then the high priest tore his clothes, which is a sign that he's heard blasphemy. And he said, "Why do we need witnesses?" They can't find any. So why do we need them? "You've heard his blasphemy. What is your decision?" And they condemned him as deserving of death, which is the punishment for blasphemy. There's no blasphemy there. But there, limited image of God, it sounds blasphemous to them. Some began to spit on him. This is in the high priest's little palace. And blindfold him and strike him and say to him, "Prophesy." And the guards, that's the temple guards, also took him over and beat him. Some of the music of Isaiah comes back in here to help us. "The Lord Yahweh has opened my ear. I was not rebellious. I didn't turn backward. I gave my back to those who struck me and my cheeks to those who pulled out my beard. I did not hide my face from insult and spitting, and the Lord Yahweh helps me. Therefore, I have not been disgraced. Therefore, I have set my face like flint. I know I will not be put to shame." And now that's all happening. And in the courtyard, the different Gospels put it differently, but you know this scene. While Peter was below in the courtyard, one of the servant girls of the high priest comes by. And when she saw Peter warming himself, she stared at him and said, "You were with Jesus, the man from Nazareth." But he denied it. I don't know what you're talking about. And he went out into the forecourt. And then the first crow crowed. The servant girl, on seeing him, began again to say to the bystanders, "This man is one of them." Again he denied it. After a little while, the bystanders said to Peter, "Certainly you're one of them, you're a Galilean." But he began to curse and swore an oath, called on God to witness, "I don't know the man you're talking about." At that moment, the cock crowed a second time. Peter remembered that Jesus said to him, "Before the cock crows twice, you'll deny me three times." And he broke down and wept. As soon as it was morning, the chief priests held a consultation with the elders and the scribes and the whole council. They bound Jesus, led him away, and handed him over to Pilate. Pilate asked him, "Are you the king of the Jews?" And Jesus says, "Well, they're your words. You are saying it." He's not going to buy into all that. "They're your words." The chief priests accused him of many things. Luke gives a list of them, but Mark doesn't. Pilate asks him again, "Have you no answer? See how many charges they're bringing against you." But Jesus made no further reply, and Pilate was amazed. Now, at the festival, he used to release a prisoner for them, anyone that they asked for. Now, there was a man there called Barabbas. Bar-Abbas is son of the father. In fact, in one of the traditions, his name is Jesus. Bar-Abbas, Jesus, son of the father. Terrible irony here. Now, that's the man. He was in prison with the rebels and had committed murder during the insurrection. So the crowd came and asked Pilate to do for them according to this custom. So Pilate answered them, "Do you want me to release for you the king of the Jews?" Said mockingly, of course. For he realized it was out of jealousy that the chief priest had handed him over. But the chief priest stirred up the crowd to have him release Barabbas instead. Pilate spoke to him again, "What do you want me to do with the man you call the king of the Jews?" And they all shouted, "Crucify him." Pilate asked them, "Why, what evil has he done?" They shouted all the more, "Crucify him." So Pilate, wishing to satisfy the crowd, released Barabbas for them, and after flogging Jesus, handed him over to be crucified. The instrument of torture is the flagellum. It's got several strands of leather plaited with pieces of bone and metal, so it actually rips the skin open. And there's no limit to how many times you can use it. The Romans, Jews had a 39 was the limit of lashing, but with the Roman flagellum, no limit. Clearly, they nearly flogged him to death, because he's, as we'll see in a second, he's too weak even to carry the crossbar of the cross. And he's a strong young man, so he's practically killed. His soldiers led him into the courtyard, into the praetorium. This is different scholars look at it. Some say it's Herod's palace, and that's highly likely. Others have in the Antonia fortress, which is on the north side of the Temple Mount, overlooking it for control. The traditional one is that. And so the journey of Jesus through the city, that's what you do if you go to Jerusalem, follows that old path. But to the best of my knowledge, most scholars today said yes, no, Pilate would have stayed in Herod the Great's palace. So it would have been a different journey. They called together the whole cohort. Wow, that's 500 men, so we've got a big stage for this one. And they clothed him in purple, a cloak, and after twisting some thorns into a crown, they put it on his head, and they began shouting, "Hail, King of the Jews!" Now, these weren't Roman soldiers. These were soldiers in the province, from Idumea, from Samaria, from Moab, Ammon. They were precisely not Jews, but they hated the Jews. So, King of the Jews, this is a bit of fun for them at last. So they're going on with all this terrible behaviour. One doesn't take the cross upon oneself. It strikes from behind, catching you off balance, gasping for support that isn't there. So it was with Jesus. He, however, embraced it, and in so doing he embraced those who thrust it upon him. It couldn't stop him loving. He embraces us too in our folly, for his broken heart cannot stop loving us with all the love of the God who wants us to know that suffering isn't part of God's plan. God doesn't want suffering. But if suffering's there, it needn't destroy us. It didn't destroy Jesus. Accepted in love, suffering can purify our heart and open it more fully to grace. And we come to our last scene. They compel a passerby who was coming in from the country to the big feast to carry Jesus' cross. It was Simon from Cyrene, the fifth largest city in northern Africa. It's in what we call Gaddafi, what country?
Libya.
It's in Libya, on the coast. And he's coming from there. And Mark adds this little bit of information. Must have a reason. He's the father of Alexander and Rufus. No doubt Alexander and Rufus by this time are Christians. In fact, in Romans 16:13, Rufus is mentioned as a member of the Roman community. No doubt the same Rufus, because the Gospel's probably written in Rome. So whatever the father did on this day, like the good thief in Luke, he must have been overwhelmed with the amazing miracle of this beautiful man, Jesus.